the court. We have one case today, United States v. Braum. But before we begin that, we're going to have a bar admission ceremony. So at this time, the court recognizes the clerk of the court, Mr. Malcolm Squires, for a motion.
May it please the court. I move for the admission of John Joseph Corzin of the state of North Carolina. I have examined his credentials in the office of the clerk, and I am satisfied he possesses the qualifications for membership in the bar of our court.
Thank you, Mr. Squires. Mr. Corzin, my colleagues and I have conferred, and we have voted unanimously to admit you to the bar of this court in light of your integrity and your legal acumen. Therefore, Mr. Squires, your motion is granted. Please administer the oath.
Thank you, sir. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will support the Constitution of the United States and that you will conduct yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court uprightly and according to law, so help you God?
Mr. Corzin, I'd like to welcome you to the bar of this court. In doing so, I think it's fitting and appropriate for me to recite the words that are engraved at the University of Virginia School of Law, to which both Judge Johnson and I attended. And those aspirational words are as follows: that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because you exemplify those ideals, it is a pleasure indeed to welcome you to the bar of this court. Thank you. You may be seated. Mr. Squires, do we have any business before the court before we proceed to oral argument?
No, Your Honor.
Very well, then. We'll now turn our attention to United States v. Braum. Mr. Hockenberry, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes.
Ms. Borland, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the amicus?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Beasold, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, then. Mr. Hockenberry, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Scott Hockenberry. Captain Samantha Castanian is at counsel's table. Along with Mr. Dan Conway, we represent Captain Braum. Chief Judge, could I reserve 5 minutes?
Granted.
This case presents a fact pattern where the government had evidence in its possession. It conceded significant portions of the evidence were relevant, but it refused to disclose the evidence or make any effort to use available tools to make it available to the defense. And for context, the government had twice represented to the defense the phone extraction did not exist, and then 2 days before trial was scheduled to begin, said that it did, and in the government's words, that it was in the government's possession. And they also disclosed more than 8 hours of previously undisclosed victim interviews. Military justice prides itself, I would say, above all else, in providing service members broad discovery. This court's stamp of approval on the government's actions here would undermine this most defining feature of the military justice system. The government's position is contrary to the truth-finding function of the court-martial, and the government is trying to frame this as if their hands were tied and there was nothing they could do. But there was a lot they could do. They could do a court order or a subpoena or an authorization. They could employ in-camera review. They could go to and seek expanded consent under a framework similar to MRE 505 or the Navy Court's opinion in JMV Peyton O'Brien or the concurrence in NRA BM. And the more I think about it, I think that is sort of the ideal solution here. And of course, the government or law enforcement could have avoided this altogether by employing a more thoughtful method of collection in the first place.
Mr. Hockenberry, you just referred to the ideal solution. Can you spell that out a little bit more?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that the government found itself in what you might call an unenviable position here, they still needed to comply with their discovery obligations. And the witness was very aligned with the government. This is the complaining witness. They could go to her and say, we need to comply with these obligations. We respect your privacy to the extent that is an interest that trumps providing this discovery. We can do that, but there are consequences to that. And that because of the way this evidence was collected, if the government felt that was necessary, they could, and then we could make a choice, an informed choice, along with the government. But what the government could not do was simply deprive appellant of evidence that they conceded was relevant.
So based on that response, I've got a hypothetical to pose to you. Let's say in a different case, complaining witness goes to law enforcement to file a complaint against an accused. At that time, the law enforcement official says, I'm going to need your phone. Complaining witness says, no, I've got a lot of private information on there. You cannot have my phone. Law enforcement official says, I'm going to take it. It's necessary for this investigation. I'm going to extract the contents and return it to you. In that hypothetical situation, how would this play out in terms of, is that information in the possession, custody, and control of the government, and must it be turned over in the course of discovery?
Yes, Your Honor, that would certainly be in the government's possession. To the extent that the seizure was done without process, the seizure may have been illegal or improper, but that would not result in exclusion.
So a rogue law enforcement official acting completely ultra vires could improperly, illegally take private information from a private citizen, and that would be disclosable in the course of a court martial.
I think it would be disclosable and probably also admissible. There's case law about, there was a case, a beating case where a confession was beat out of a co-accused, and that was admissible because there was no standing to challenge it. So, yes, I think that would be.
So, counsel, it sounds like you're admitting that would be a Fourth Amendment violation by that officer, the ultra-various officer in the chief's hypothetical.
Your Honor, to the extent it was done without process, it may have been the seizure was illegal. I think there's an argument that the seizure here was illegal.
Fine. So if we have a Fourth Amendment violation, and you say then that the President in RCM 701 has ordered the government then to turn that information over to the defense, where would the President get the authority to order the government to engage in a Fourth Amendment violation for whatever purpose?
Well, Your Honor, the Fourth Amendment violation would, have already happened.
Okay. Well, has the Fourth Amendment, if there's a Fourth Amendment violation that might have occurred in this case, has it already happened?
Well, there's an argument that law enforcement exceeded the scope of consent when they originally took this data.
Now, didn't they tell her? They said, no, this didn't they? I thought they explained to her, we're going to download the data because that's the only way our software works, and we're going to have it. But we're committing to you that we will only search and take that which you have consented to us taking. I thought that was what they explained to her.
Yeah, I think some of that is in the record. That they explained they would download all of it is in the report from the sheriff's office. I think we may be reading between the lines somewhat as to how that conversation went. I would have liked to see a more fulsome discussion of the facts. And I know it was the defense's burden, but this happened. The motion was filed one day before trial due to the late disclosure. But
Let's say we believe that they did commit to her that they would not search her data or examine her data beyond what she consented. Would any further search of that data by the government be a Fourth Amendment violation?
Your Honor, I think that it would not be because the Fourth Amendment is designed to protect defendants from the government, not protect the government from providing conceitedly relevant information to defendants.
Well, let's take that. So what if they found child pornography on her phone, and then they had turned it over to the feds. The feds bring charges. She would have you're a defense attorney. She'd have an ironclad defense that there had been a Fourth Amendment violation right?
Well, the standing of a defendant to challenge the admissibility of evidence at trial is very different than the standing
No one's trying to intervene here. What I'm asking about, if there's a Fourth Amendment violation, she may have no cause of action. Say the government did search her data, or maybe we think that exposing her data to a third party, including the defendant, violates the Fourth Amendment. She may have no cause of action. She may have no remedy, but there's still a violation, isn't there?
Your Honor, I think that evidence is provided in discovery all the time that witnesses have an expectation of privacy in, and consent may be one way that is provided, but usually there is not consent. The government is acting as if a lack of consent is like a total bar to providing in discovery, but the vast majority of evidence is not obtained via consent. We pointed to HVZ where The court specifically said there's a constitutional privacy interest. But it's in the hands of military authorities, and so we're just going to issue a subpoena?
I mean, like, we keep using the euphemism of privacy interest, right? Privacy interest is a very different thing from a Fourth Amendment violation. And here, what you're suggesting is if we think the disclosure of her data to a third party is a Fourth Amendment, that she has not consented to, and I don't think there's any probable cause for the government to search the rest of the data on her phone. If that's a Fourth Amendment violation, whether she has a cause of action or a remedy, I don't think matters. Then where does the president have the authority? You say RCM 701 demands that outcome, right? The government must, because the president has told them so in RCM 701, disclose that data to a third party. Now, if that is a Fourth Amendment violation, whether or not there's a remedy, where does the president get the authority to override the Fourth Amendment and command the government to do that?
Well, Your Honor, the government didn't have to do that and did not have to allow them to if, under the framework of 505, they could decide not to. But that would have consequences to the prosecution. But as quoted by the amicus, this court has clarified or has held that the prosecutor's obligation is to remove obstacles to defense access to evidence. To the extent the government felt the method of collection was an obstacle, well, first we would say that the federal government is not bound by the sheriff's office and their method of collection, but to the extent the government felt that was an obstacle, they could use any number of the tools available to them to collect this evidence, and that would fulfill their obligation to remove obstacles. Doing nothing violated their obligation to remove obstacles. The government here, and this is an important part of the case, the government here conceded that seven or eight areas of this evidence were relevant.
Well, let's get to that, right? Because there is another solution here. You've thrown out a lot of hypotheticals that the government could have done in a more perfect case. But there's also 703, right? And I know that the defense did move under 703 to get the same data. And the military judge said, no, you haven't established that you have any right to this data. So why isn't that the safety valve, right? Well, there's no the safety. It's not that there's no mechanism in the rules for the defense to get this data if they're entitled to it. There is a mechanism, and they attempted it, and they lost. And I don't think the defense has appealed that ruling, the 703 ruling.
Your Honor, I know that's not the main point in our brief. I think it is within the granted issue, and I do think that the military judge erred by not providing it under 703. But I don't think that some degree of
You say that, but am I wrong that that wasn't appealed?
Yeah,
that issue is not raised to this court.
I think it is the granted issue is broad enough to cover it. That's certainly not our main argument. Our main argument is 701, which is the lower standard. But in terms of production would require not just relevance, which was conceded, but relevant and necessary meaning non-cumulative. The military judge said the text messages are cumulative. That turned out to be wrong, did not address any of the other areas that the government conceded were relevant. The judge did say the entire extraction has not been shown to be necessary under a 703 production standard. That's probably correct. But what about all those other areas? The judge didn't even address that.
Counsel, could you use some of your remaining time to talk about prejudice, assuming we agree that the information should have been turned over? This is an unusual, not necessarily unusual, but a different kind of discovery issue where it's not like there might have been something on the phone that appellant didn't know about. The value of what was on the phone was it confirmed that what was on appellant's phone had not been tampered with, that it was complete and hadn't been changed. And so I guess the question is, what specific items of evidence were called into question which, if only they had been believed, might have changed the result?
Your Honor, I think the text messages fall under that, the text messages between the two of them fall under that dynamic you're describing. I think that's enough in and of itself to determine prejudice. But there were a number of other evidence.
Well, which of those text messages are you talking about? I mean, which ones were sort of exculpatory? I mean, it's not like, I mean, a simplest case would be she sent a text message saying, I consented to everything, and then, or I didn't consent to anything, and he deleted it, or one of those, something like that. But you're not alleging anything. You say we've got all the text messages. Your position has to be that everything on his phone is the same as on her phone. And so I'm just trying to see, like, which which part of the evidence on his phone might have been disbelieved such that the result would have been changed?
Your Honor, I think the text messages were highly contradictory to his narrative about appellant unilaterally introducing some alternative so-called BDSM into the relationship. And then when the text messages came out, she's sending him all these very graphic things of that same nature. And then when confronted with that at trial, she kind of says, well, I think the defense is not presenting an accurate picture of my text messages, which the other messages, the mirror copy, if you will, would have confirmed or contradicted. Now, I think the government and the Air Force Court just focus on the text messages in terms of prejudice, and under the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard, that's certainly enough. The prejudice of not having those messages was very significant. But the defense on JA at 484 and the government conceded on JA at 548 listed a number of other areas of relevant information that just due to the surrounding circumstances they were able to determine would be expected to be on the phone. None of those would be redundant or duplicative on anything. And the Air Force Court's prejudice analysis does not account for his question of the veracity of the messages. The government does acknowledge that she questioned the veracity of the messages, but then said appellant would know whether they were accurate or not. But the fact that he might know doesn't mean he doesn't need access to evidence that would confirm that. That's like saying the appellant knows whether he's guilty or not, so he doesn't need — that's just not a relevant framework. And then the Air Force Court said prejudice is speculative. Well, it's speculative because the record does not contain the data because of the violation. If we reach prejudice, it's because there was error. So,
but on that particular point, I mean, your client's position must be that the data is the same on as on his phone. I mean, that the speculativeness is only about if only they had been confirmed that these two things were the same, they might have believed that she was a liar, or they might have believed that that the whole thing couldn't, that everything had been established or something. But, I mean, it's not speculative. Your position can't be that it's speculative as to what was on the phone, because your client's position is he didn't tamper with his phone.
Your Honor, could I answer
please respond to Judge Maggs.
Your Honor, it was the Air Force Court that said it was speculative. In terms of the text messages would have not allowed you to deny the messages that contradicted her story. But the defense also proffered all those other areas, videos of the flying, which was part of the narrative in a charge of offense, injury photos, the documentation that was referencing during her law enforcement interviews, whether it be notes or a script, the text messages, which is the only thing that Air Force Court talked about, the web history demonstrating his involvement in the subjects at issue, and other information pertaining to BDSM, and how the Amazon.com screenshot got on cell phone, which was another significant credibility issue at trial. So there's a lot more areas that were specifically identified and the government conceded were relevant.
Further questions from the bench? Judge Sparks?
Chief, could I pose a question and allow Mr. Hockenberry maybe to think about this in return on rebuttal? And my question is this. I'd like you to think about, or at least tell me, some of the tools that you're thinking the government or even the judge, whomever, might have used. In other words, at the point, I'm trying to see how this plays out procedurally. When the government received the defense discovery request, the government said, hey, look, we cannot provide this information because of this third party's constitutional rights against disclosing it. So then I think the defense counsel did the right thing, went to the military judge and said, hey, look, we need disclosure of this information. Now, the military judge ruled that the government did not have legal custody or possession of the information. And that was that, and that's how he ruled, and the motion was denied. Now, what I'm wondering is, who had the obligation to do what at the time the military judge made that ruling? Should the defense have issued another, made another plea to the judge and said, hey, Judge, look, there are all these other tools that the government can use. You could review this stuff in camera. You could, I think, under MRE 315, hold a probable cause hearing now and determine whether or not there's probable cause to go get this information or for the government to go get it. Or, you know, any number of things. But who had the obligation, if anything, if anyone, to do what at that point? And are those tools actually tools that could have resolved this issue as we look back against the record? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Mr. Hockenberry, yes, I'll give you time now to respond to that question in light of the detailed nature of it, mm-hmm. and I'll grant the government additional time if appropriate.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor, I think the defense raised some of those possibilities in their motion, and again, this motion, although I thought the motion was well done, it was filed at the very last minute due to the discovery violation. But the defense certainly said trial counsel has the power to subpoena the evidence. They said that in their motion. In terms of in-camera review, the military judge certainly could have employed that. As pointed out by the amicus, the government's objection here is that there was a conflict between the defense search for information and the government's need to protect information. And this court has specifically said what tool a military judge has in that situation, which is in-camera review. So, I certainly think the defense motion was sufficient to...
Could the defense have redirected the military judge to MRE 315? Now, the old rules list the people who can actually order or issue probable cause a determination. I noticed in the new rules, relatively new, it says with regard to digital data or information, only a military judge can issue a probable cause determination for the government to go seek that information. So here, I guess I'm kind of wondering how any of this would have played out. In other words, did the government have the obligation when they received your client's defense discovery request to go do something like get a probable cause hearing, get the military judge to look at it in camera? Did the defense counsel have some obligation to, barring, the government not doing anything, did the defense counsel have the obligation to remind the military judge about these tools that, and then to press that issue? I know you mentioned that they've indicated to the military judge in a motion about the subpoenas potential. But is that the error here? Is the military judge's error that he or she didn't look farther at the tools before resolving this issue on this legal possession theory?
I think so. Both the government and the military judge as the authority to enforce the government's obligations. But this court has been very clear that it is the prosecutor's obligation to remove obstacles to defense access to evidence. And in Stilato, the government has a duty to use good faith and due diligence to make evidence available to the accused. So I think it is the government's obligation, and to the extent the unusual method of collection here made that more complicated than it would usually be, they still have to remove obstacles and use due diligence to make evidence available, and the judge would be there to enforce that if the government did not agree to do it on its own.
And I'm not suggesting how such any ruling would have come out. I'm just trying to understand, with the availability of these other kinds of tools in the manual, I'm just wondering who had the obligation to do what regarding the point at which the judge was making his decision that the government, you lose defense because the government is not in legal possession of this information.
Right. The government had the obligation to remove obstacles and make evidence available to the defense, especially after conceding significant portions of it were relevant. The judge had the obligation to enforce those duties. I don't think defense needs to list every possible option in their motion, although they did discuss some of these. I think the defense obligation is to raise the issue, and then it's the government's obligation to comply with discovery.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hockenberry. Ms. Bowen?
May it please the Court. My name is Vivian Bullen, amicus counsel arguing in support of the appellant on the discovery issue. Today, this Court has the opportunity to affirm the broad grant of discovery rights afforded to military defendants and to protect the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial by not reading the word legal into RCM 701. When analyzing a rule, the Court first looks to its plain text, then to its specific and broader contexts. Expanding on appellant's argument, the specific and broader contexts of RCM 701 here support a ruling for appellant on the discovery issue for two reasons. First, such a ruling would promote fair play by enforcing the government's discovery obligations. And second, it would preserve this Court's commitment to the equal access mandate in RCM 701. Turning to my first point, the plain language approach aligns with the express purpose of the rule, to promote fair play. The drafters of RCM 701 intended for this rule to be a broad grant of discovery to military defendants, as evidenced by the analysis of the rule, which states that it's intended to provide discovery to the maximum extent possible.
So could I address that point? Maximum extent possible. You heard the hypothetical that I posed to Mr. Hockenberry in terms of a rogue law enforcement officer. I was interested in page 20 of your brief. You referred to reasonable expectation of privacy. Your point being that here, by turning over the phone willingly, that her reasonable expectation of privacy had been greatly reduced. Is that a limiting principle? Is that something that this court could look towards in terms of saying a rogue law enforcement official would not put the government in a position where it had to turn things over because of the fact that the complaining witness did not have a reduced expectation of privacy? But in this case, because the complaining witness did turn it over, it was appropriate for discovery.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Your Honor. And that argument relies on United States v. Lutzka, a 2017 case by the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. And while, of course, that's not binding precedent on this court can look to that case for the proposition that the reasonable expectation of privacy in a lawfully seized government-created copy of evidence does not carry with it a reasonable expectation of privacy. And that case, furthermore, was about a defendant, whereas here we're talking about a witness's privacy interests. And so while if carried a reasonable expectation of privacy in the data, its discoverability might come out differently if the extraction had not been fully turned over to the government, the fact that she consented to the full extraction, understanding the government would be in full physical possession of that material, necessitates disclosure in this case.
I think Judge Johnson may have had a question.
No, Chief. I'll circle back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Furthermore, the broad grant of discovery in RCM 701 aligns with the regulatory scheme of the military criminal justice system, which grants broader rights to military defendants than its civilian counterparts in various areas. These include more exacting speedy trial rights, more expansive Miranda protections, and a broader right to counsel. Given this context, the breadth of the government's obligation under 701 is clear, and a narrow interpretation which reads in legal ignores this context. The specific context of RCM 701 speaks to this as well, with subsection F laying out explicit exceptions to the broad grant of discovery in subsection A.
Well, and counsel, this was the question I was going to ask. I was going to follow on with Chief. So, and speaking with regards to F and the exceptions, and it also says, or in, you know, violation or consistent with other MRE rules. And so you have other MRE rules that could be constraints on this, one of which being 314E3, which talks about consent may be limited by time, place, or property, and that the government must comply with those limitations. And so even your argument is we need to look at the four corners of 701, but even within the four corners of 701, there are constraints. How do you reconcile that?
Your Honor, I think there are two ways to reconcile that. The first is that mechanisms, as discussed earlier, like in-camera review and protection orders can come into play here. And in fact, this court in United States v. Abrams in 1999 stated that in-camera review is the preferred practice for balancing a witness's privacy interests against the government's discovery obligations. And the second point is that the government can in the future seek informed consent from witnesses when acquiring evidence from them. Here, the government obtained the full extraction without informing that it might have to be that might have to be subject to disclosure under RCM 701. And in the future, by having clear practices and standards when gathering evidence, the limited consent issue can be avoided.
How do we think about her consent if she was, if we believe, as the government suggests, that the government did commit to her that her data would be secure and that they would only access the data that she gave them express consent to access?
Your Honor, the government's Fourth Amendment obligations here in no way diminish its discovery, the discovery rights of appellant and its obligations to appellant. And so,
is that right? I mean, don't we have a conflict? Whether the word legal appears in the text of RCM 701 or not, we still have a hierarchy of laws problem, right? I mean, no rule of court-martial can contravene the Constitution, right?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I would argue, consistent with appellant's argument, that if a Fourth Amendment violation did occur in this case, it would not be when the extraction was turned over to defense, but instead when the extraction was obtained without the full informed consent of.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry. Will you?
No, go ahead.
So let's back up a little bit, because Judge Hardy's kind of hitting two points when you analyze this. In the Fourth Amendment context, we have the seizure, which would have been the extraction, and then we have the search of the copies of the extraction. And so is it your position, because I think I just heard you say, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, that are you questioning the legality of the seizure?
Your Honor, I would be questioning the legality of the seizure within the specific context of them obtaining a full extraction of her phone that the government had physical possession of and access to. And that questioning falls under the jurisprudence of this court and United States v. Secord from July of this year, in which the court found that RCM 701 is meant to provide parties with equal access to evidence. And while in that case disclosure was not necessary because the government and defendant were both excluded from the information contained within the phone, those facts are distinguished from the facts in the current case. Here, unlike in Secord, there was not a passcode preventing the government from accessing the information within the extraction. The government had full physical possession over all of that data in this case, and appellant was unable to access any of it. And in preserving this court's commitment to equal access of evidence, finding that the phone extraction should have been disclosed would be consistent with that mandate.
Counsel, what would have happened if the government had turned over all the data to the defense? The defense searched the data. They found evidence of criminal activity, and they turned that over to civilian authorities. Could the civilian authorities then – we're in a Fourth Amendment conundrum here. Could the civilian authorities then use that data lawfully in a conviction against the victim? Or in a prosecution against the victim? Have we sort of laundered our way around all the Fourth Amendment violations because she consented to give them the data, but then they had an obligation to turn it over, and now we have a third-party review, and they gave it to the police? Like, is that – are we clear of all Fourth Amendment concerns at that point?
Your Honor, at that point, the information would not be admissible at trial against – because there would be standing in that case – to challenge the evidence under the exclusionary rule as being obtained illegally in violation of the Fourth Amendment. But because
are there only Fourth Amendment violations, or does the Fourth Amendment only protect violations in for which a victim or the person having their things searched or seized has standing to complain about it?
The Fourth Amendment does not only protect people when they would have standing. However, remedies for Fourth Amendment violations are often constrained to situations in which there would be standing to challenge that violation.
Ms. Bolden, can I ask you a question about this issue with the third parties constitutional rights? In other words, let's assume for the moment, I know we've talked a lot about how this evidence was taken from the third party and whether that party's Fourth Amendment interest in it somehow may affect the accused Fourth Amendment interest. But let's assume for the moment, for my question, that the evidence was properly taken from the third party, victim in this case, and she has limited her consent appropriately or properly and has made it clear that I don't want an intrusion or disclosure of this other information that you're taking from me or that I'm voluntarily giving to you. And the government's main question is basically, hey, look, we can't provide defense this information because of this third party's Fourth Amendment protections. So, yeah, I guess what I'm wondering is, in your view, listening to your comments about the rule for court-martial, you're not suggesting that the RCM of its own, on its own, can be used to invade the Fourth Amendment shield of the third party's information, are you? You know what I'm asking? You agreed earlier that, to Judge Hardy's question, that the rules for court-martial cannot supersede the Constitution. But if the victim has a constitutional right to avoid disclosure of information that she possesses, or her information, regardless of whether it's an accused or is it someone else, that protection still exists. You'd still have to get around that, don't you?
Yes,
Your Honor. And you're not suggesting, I thought you maybe were suggesting that 703 or 701 on their own is enough to breach the protections of the third party's Fourth Amendment rights.
And, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Please respond to Judge Spartan.
Thank you. Your Honor, it is not that anything in the rules of court-martial would supersede the Constitution, but that defendants have no control over the government's compliance with constitutional obligations that are owed to others. And RCM 701 is enshrined in the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution because discovery obligations are incredibly relevant to a defendant's right.
No, I understand. I agree with you, but I hope you're not saying, or maybe I'm misunderstanding, is that, hey, look, regardless of anything else, whatever the interests are of the third party has nothing to do with the RCMs and my court-martial as the accused. You know, the rules for court-martial should allow me on their own to seek information possessed by a third party given to the government under a consent agreement.
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree that, yes, that under the rules of court-martial and the Sixth Amendment, defendants must be allowed to seek discovery to the maximum extent.
Right, now, that's different from what Judge Hardy might have been getting at, I think, with regard to a remedy. In fact, you know, I'm not so sure I can complain about the invasion of this third party's rights to prevent admissibility of evidence taken from them used against me. She has a right to do that in her own criminal trial. But I'm asking now is that, and I think you seem to be confirming that the RCM on its own, without the use of any of these tools that we've talked with Mr. Hockenberry, can be used on its own to invade or disregard, whatever the word you want to use, the interests of the third party.
Your Honor, it is not that the RCM itself would be used to invade the interests of a third party, but that when the government commits a constitutional violation, that does not free it of its duty to provide discovery in a case.
I'm not saying that they have, in my scenario, at least my hypothetical, I'm not saying there's been a Fourth Amendment violation. I'm saying that the government is confronted with a situation, they have a discovery request, and they say, hey, look, we can't provide this. This third party interest is preventing us from getting this information. Now, I talked with Mr. Hockenberry about, you know, who has to do what at that point. But just on that narrow question, I think you're agreeing with me that if the government can't necessarily use 701, 703 on its own to invade that interest, but they have to do something to get that information. They have to at least show some regard for the third party's Fourth Amendment protections. Now, I won't put words in your mouth, but is that what you're saying?
Well, Your Honor, certainly there are mechanisms in place, like in-camera review, that the government can seek in such instances and that are meant for these exact purposes. And in-camera review is especially helpful because it allows the military judge an opportunity to inspect the evidence and consider the government's concerns.
Sure. So it sounds like what you're saying is maybe what I might have misunderstood you to say. I guess you're not saying, as I was kind of trying to blame you for saying, was that only the rule by itself and nothing else can invade the protections of the third party's constitutional rights.
Yes, Your Honor, the rule by itself cannot invade the constitutional obligations of others.
Any further questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Boland.
Thank you.
Captain Beasel.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Heather Beasold, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, I represent the United States. The rules of discovery cannot force the government to violate the Fourth Amendment. That is the critical context in which this court must interpret the words possession, custody, or control. The rules only allow appellant to stand in the shoes of the government. It does not entitle him to unilaterally rummage through vast amounts of private data that the government was blocked from accessing by the Fourth Amendment. Because the government did not have access, it did not have possession, custody, or control, and appellant was not entitled to the full extraction of the phone.
Can I interrupt you early so I don't get blamed for making more time on the record later on? Again, once the government receives this request, and they're confronted with this obstacle. You heard my conversation with both the amicus and with Mr. Hockenberry, right? Once they're presented with this, what are they supposed to do with it? What are they obliged to do? What can they do? In other words, they get a request saying, we need this information. They say, hey, look, this is protected by the shield around the third party's information. And that shield is that third party's Fourth Amendment protections, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So rather than say, and your brief has a great exposition on the Fourth Amendment, I was informed of things I had forgotten in law school. But it left me with the question, all right, once you know you have this Fourth Amendment barrier in front of you regarding this third party, then what? What are you supposed to do, if anything? If this was information the government wanted, what would they do? They would go seek a search authorization, would they not?
Correct, Your Honor. If the government thought that there was relevant or exculpatory or even just favorable information to the defense on this phone, we absolutely would have sought a search authorization. That was not the case here. We had asked for the entirety of her phone because the officers thought that there might be something that would be helpful for the investigation, and when she denied that, we had absolutely no indication that there was anything favorable to the defense.
I understand that. I understand. So your position, I think, is that, hey, look, we got this information, but if the witness said she didn't want it disclosed, we don't have a right to disclose any of it, even if we don't know whether we know what's on it or not. Right?
Yes, Your Honor. And at that
point, then what's supposed to happen next? Defense counsel, I imagine what you're going to say, hey, look, over to trial defense counsel. What are they supposed to do?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Because the Fourth Amendment was a bar, it was not in the government's possession, custody, or control, and so it was not subject to disclosure under RCM 701.
But based on your response to Judge Sparks, you seem to be placing the government in the role of a gatekeeper who chooses not to unlock the gate. You said if the government wanted information from that phone, the government would have sought a search authorization. But here, when that information could benefit the accused, the government stands by and says, oh, we can't do anything about this. How is that fundamentally fair?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with the characterization that if we had thought that it was favorable to the accused, we still wouldn't have sought a subpoena. We absolutely would have sought a subpoena if they had made any kind of a showing that there was evidence favorable to him on this phone. We actually did that with the Amazon records. He made some showing that there were Amazon records that were not favorable to the government and were not introduced by the government. We went and got those for him because we had that indication. And we would have done the same thing with the phone. But in this case, we didn't have any indication. And so at that point, because it was not in our possession, custody, or control, it was the defense's obligation under RCM 703 to show that the information that they wanted was relevant and necessary. And they couldn't meet that burden in this case.
But couldn't they? Was the problem they had in meeting the burden that the military judge had closed the door on that, to use another door analogy, where the military judge ruled there is a term legal that appears nowhere in the plain language, but I'm going to import it into the rule, and that prevents you, appellant, accused, from getting this information. That barrier was insurmountable by the accused at trial.
Well, Your Honor, that barrier was the barrier of the Fourth Amendment is what I believe that the judge was talking about when he said that it had to be in the legal possession of the government for us to have to turn it under RCM 701. And so I agree that the Fourth Amendment was an insurmountable barrier to him getting access to the complete extraction under RCM 701. But he could have shown that it was relevant and necessary for us to produce that information under RCM 703.
But it really became relevant in the course of the testimony of the complaining witness, who kept on saying, this information has been cherry-picked and edited. It was then that it became relevant, but the defense knew that the military judge had already set an insurmountable barrier by saying, legal is part of this provision, and it was not in the legal possession, custody, or control of the government. And the law doesn't require a party to engage in a useless act.
That's true, Your Honor. But the critical point is that the legal consideration for possession, custody, and control was for RCM 701. He could have, under RCM 703, required the government to go and get a subpoena for her phone and required the witness herself to produce her phone and the relevant and necessary information within. And you highlighted a particular point where it became relevant when she was being cross-examined and she kind of waffled about whether or not these were the entirety of the text messages.
Well, she didn't waffle, counsel.
That's true, Your Honor. She did indicate that there might have been missing or there were missing messages. And at that point, it was the defense's obligation to renew their motion under RCM 703 to say at this point, it absolutely is relevant and necessary for us to complete our impeachment of this witness. And they didn't do that. They chose a different strategic tactic where 8 times in her cross-examination, they gave her the opportunity to turn over those messages and questioned her about why she was not turning over those messages. And that was powerful cross-examination. It showed that she was intentionally trying to potentially hide something from the fact finder, and it impeached her credibility. So where they made a strategic decision to instead impeach her through cross-examination rather than raise their motion under RCM 703 again, that was their decision to do so, but it was their obligation to re-raise the issue.
So I'd like to switch gears a little bit in terms of your hierarchical analysis here, where in your brief at least, and I'd like you to address this point, you seem to be setting up the duel between the victim's paramount constitutional right to privacy versus the accused subordinate, essentially right to discovery under the rules. But is it more appropriate to look at this as a duel between constitutional right to privacy and constitutional right to a fair trial, so that there isn't this hierarchy? There are two constitutional rights that were in tension in that courtroom.
Your Honor, I have two answers for this. First, I don't think that it implicates a constitutional right on behalf of the appellant. Appellant does not have a constitutional right to discovery, and the Supreme Court has been clear about that. To the extent that
Doesn't McHugh have a constitutional right to a fair trial?
He absolutely does, Your Honor. And that constitutional right to a fair trial is insured through RCM 703. And so he had the opportunity to get this information produced and show that it was relevant and necessary to a fair trial in his argument under 703, and he couldn't meet that burden. But also, Your Honor, even when there are competing constitutional considerations, the right to privacy is so fundamental that the Supreme Court has even found that it overrode a First Amendment right to the freedom of press. There's a case that I'd like to draw this Court's attention to, Wilson v. Lane.
So the interests that a person has not to be embarrassed surmounts the interest a person has not to be incarcerated for 9 years?
Your Honor, it's not an interest in a lack of embarrassment. It's a fundamental right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. And the witness, whether it's a victim or whether it's any other person, that right is paramount. And to the extent that it butts up against a right to a fair trial, the President has considered that and has implemented RCM 703 to address it.
Can you point to any case law where those two have been in tension?
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I cannot think of a case where they have been in tension, but I would be happy to provide a supplemental citation at the conclusion of this.
Counsel, could you turn your attention to the issue of prejudice? Let's suppose either we disagree or we assume that with your position, or we assume that there was an error, as the CCA did. Can you respond to what appellant counsel just said about prejudice, about the whole reason that this evidence was necessary and how the government has not shown that there was a lack of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. So there was a lack of prejudice. Any nondisclosure of her data absolutely was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. There's not a reasonable possibility that it might have affected the verdict.
Why?
Because the victim's testimony is what was at issue. That's what the defense wanted to cross-examine her on. They wanted to show that she was untruthful. But everything that they wanted to show that she was untruthful about were all the surrounding circumstances of their relationship, what their sexual activity was, how they had been flying in the plane together, things like that. It had nothing, they didn't have anything to contradict her testimony about the actual sexual assault. So
wait a minute, though. I don't understand your point. This all gets down to the issue of consent. It was not a situation where the accused claimed, we never had sex, we never had this type of sex. It was that she consented. The government in its brief cites things such as, well, she knew where the box of sex toys was located. There are indications in his in-flight log that sex occurred. Where does that go to the issue of whether there was consent or not, as compared to the fact that there was, or the point that there was sex?
Your Honor, the issue of consent, was addressed. The defense thoroughly impeached the witness.
Well, when you say thoroughly impeached, the complaining witness repeatedly said that what she was being impeached with, the defense version of these text messages, had been cherry-picked, were incomplete, and had been edited. The only way that the defense could show that that was incorrect is to have her version. And so the defense really was stymied. She was essentially telling the panel members, I am being impeached all over the place here. They're showing from their version of the text messages that I was making these comments that were consistent with my enjoyment of BDSM and so forth. But you panel members shouldn't believe it, because what they're showing you for these text messages were cherry-picked and edited. How is the defense going to rebut that, refute that, unless they had access to the version that was in the possession of the government.
Your Honor, they didn't need the version that was in the possession of the government because they were able to effectively cross-examine her and take any credibility out of her claim that these messages were altered in any way.
Are you saying she was incredible?
I'm saying that she wasn't credible about her claim that the messages were altered because they asked her 8 times if she would be willing to turn over her messages so that she could show to the panel that these messages were altered, and she denied it 8 times. And so that thoroughly impeached.
Doesn't that put the government in a strange posture where, as part of the HBRD analysis, we have to look at the strength of the government's case? And you've just told us, wow, this complaining witness was really impeached. 8 times they pointed out that she had credibility problems, plus the defense brought in her former best friend who said, hey, my best friend from before has a reputation for not being honest. Why shouldn't this court say in its HBRD analysis the government's case wasn't strong at all?
Your Honor, because the impeachment about the text messages and the witness that spoke of her lack of credibility, none of that changed whether or not she was being truthful about the violent assaults that she was subjected to. And there was significant credibility in her accounts of what happened, particularly her daughter witnessing the final altercation in which she ended the relationship. And so the fact finders were able to hear that she might have been minimizing her involvement in this type of sexual activity. They pointed out that she denied purchasing certain sex toys, and then were able to introduce the Amazon records to show that these sex toys had been purchases, and she even had to admit that she had used a particular toy on one occasion. But all of the consensual sexual activity that might have occurred around the sexual assaults does not mean that she was not being truthful about the actual assaults on the days that they occurred. Because she could have been consenting previously and not been consenting at the moment that she was assaulted. And
true, but how does this court, at the appellate level, in the course of conducting its HBRD analysis, factor that into the strength of the government's case, strength of the defense case? It seems to undercut the government.
Your Honor, because it wouldn't have moved the needle. If they had impeached her one more time.
But moving the needle, is that part of the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
Yes, Your Honor, because
where does that fit in?
If the evidence might have affected the verdict, then it cannot be said to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case,
but how do we know that? I recognize your argument. It's a good one to say that it doesn't mean because someone is untruthful in one area, they're untruthful in another. That could be counterbalanced by the idea of faults in one, faults in all. That is certainly an issue that, as a panel member, they could have discussed and decided upon. But I'm asking at this appellate level, that's not a factor that we find in our harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis.
Your Honor, because the government's case was strong in her testimony about what happened to her on the nights of the sexual assault, we agree that she was impeached about surrounding circumstances, but that doesn't invalidate the strength of the government's case when she testified about the flight log with the stars on it on the days that she was assaulted.
Which goes to show that they had sex in flight, but it doesn't go to show that it was non-consensual sex in flight, right?
Correct, Your Honor, but further her testimony about the injuries from when she was assaulted by the appellant and her daughter witnessing that final altercation all corroborates her account of the events on the day that she was assaulted. And so in that regard, the government's case was strong, and additional opportunity for the defense to again impeach her about these messages and her tangential interest in BDSM would not have impacted the verdict. And so this court should find that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I'd like to take a minute to talk about the point that the amicus brought up, that the government could have sought in-camera.
Counsel, I just want to say there was additional time granted by the court for argument for defense and amicus. I want to assure you I will grant you additional time to fully make your argument in addition to any questions posed by the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So take your time.
Your Honor, so the amicus brought up and the defense argued somewhat that there could have been in-camera review to balance these privacy interests. But importantly, the court never could have gotten in-camera review of this information without also violating the Fourth Amendment. The judge is a government actor, and even if he wasn't, the act of the government turning this information over to the judge to look at would have continued to violate her Fourth Amendment rights. And this court should be cautious in considering creating an in-camera standard for review of data when it has been extracted under this two-step process of seizure and search for data. Because
I think if we want to put the appellant's argument in a better light, is the government invited some problems on itself when it placed a copy of all her cell phone data on its server. Right. We can argue about whether it was in possession, custody, or control of it. But the fact of the matter is they had a copy of all of her data on their server that if they wanted to, legal niceties aside, they could have accessed. Right. So the government has sort of placed itself in this very awkward position relevant to RCM 701. And then I think what the chief is really asking is the government having put itself in this weird position, what might it have done to try and extricate itself from this weird position without doing something that the government thought was illegal?
Your Honor, I don't think the government has an obligation to extricate itself from that position. In the same sense as when we execute a warrant to seize somebody's phone, we download the entirety of the data, but we're narrowly limited in the searches that we can do of that data. I wouldn't say that the government has put itself in a position where we then have to jump through hoops to get that information to the defense. It's the defense's obligation to show that that information is relevant and necessary for their case. They attempted to do so here, and they couldn't. But the in-camera review piece, it doesn't address the issue. Importantly, I'd like to turn this Court's attention to MRE 513, where there is an in-camera process, and that's the process that's being talked about in the cases cited by the amicus, is 513 and its progeny 506 before 513 existed. And there is a very high burden for the Court to get to in-camera review. There are four steps that the moving party has to show before the judge can even look at this information, and that's a presidentially created confidentiality or privacy interest. And so when there's such a high burden to get there, even for a presidentially created confidentiality interest, it should not be a lower burden of mere relevance in order to get access to something that is protected by a constitutional privacy interest in the Fourth Amendment. Seeing my time has expired, Your Honor, may I briefly conclude?
Let me first ask whether my colleagues have any further questions for you.
Yes, sir.
Anything else? Please conclude.
Your Honor, the government had neither possession, custody, or control of this information, and so appellant was not entitled to the full extraction of the phone. Therefore, this Court should affirm the lower court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Beasel. Mr. Hockenberry.
Your Honor, there were some concessions I would highlight, which, to the government's credit, I appreciate that. If the government thought there was relevant data, they would have sought an authorization. But the government at trial conceded there was at least 6 points of relevant data that the cross-examination showed was intentionally trying to hide something. Well, that's why the defense needed discovery, which goes to both the error and, of course, to prejudice.
Why didn't the defense, having lost the pretrial motion, why didn't the defense, once the victim had testified and maybe there was new justification for a 703 order, why not raise it then? Why isn't that forfeited if they let it go by?
Well, Your Honor, it's certainly not forfeited. I think case law is clear. Defense only needs to make a motion once. They certainly could have renewed it. I mean, that might have been a good thing to do, but they're not required to. And one of the reasons for broad disclosure and limited privileges is to prevent surprise. And this is exactly the type of surprise that needs to be prevented.
So was this an error by the military judge for not sua sponte recognizing that there might, he might need to revisit his 703 ruling?
It could have been. I mean, I think the military judge, erred at the time of making the ruling. It could have been revisited. I do think that the case law says that discovery requests are ongoing. I think it explicitly says that, and they don't need to be repeated.
And earlier you suggested that the 703 question was within the scope of our QP. I'm going to read you the QP because I don't see it. Because it says, can the government properly refuse to disclose relevant non-privileged data in its possession, custody, and control on the basis that the witness who provided the data gave limited consent with respect to its use? I don't see anything in that about 703.
That is a good point, Your Honor. Perhaps I think it says,
it then
did
says,
the military judge error?
And then I don't see any mention of 703 in your briefs, except on page 9, when you suggest that, said, by the government's own terms, the government, the court, and the appellant could have obtained the phone data via RCM 703 without violating the victim's Fourth Amendment rights, but attaining the same discovery via 701 would apparently cause a small constitutional crisis. To my quick scan, that is the only mention of 703 in either your primary or reply brief.
Your Honor, I think that's right. We try to find something beyond repeating the briefs for oral argument, but your point is well taken.
All right. So it's perhaps still but it's still your opinion that the 703 question, we could still find that the military judge erred by not granting the 703 motion.
I think so, Your Honor. That would just be a question of error correction, but I do think that was a clear error. And I do also think that they're intertwined. I don't think some degree of process is inconsistent with a 701 analysis in terms of the government seems to be putting this framework forward through 315 or whatever, that if there's not consent, there's no way to get something. But there's all sorts of evidence that the various witnesses have not consented to, that the whole line of Millett cases about evidence in the possession of military authorities being the hospitals, no consent to get that. But that's obtained through 701, and it's just obtained through a court order. So, and there's a constitutional privacy interest there too. The lack of consent is not some sort of bar to ever providing something in discovery.
But counsel, government just argued using that MRE 5513 analysis, the procedural stages that a military judge has to go through, or the parties and the judge must go through, in order to get to the point of kind of piercing the confidentiality. And so how would you respond to that, that those same 513 procedures weren't followed here? We don't have that same bar in 703 or the same process.
Right. Well, Your Honor, 513 is a privilege, and I may have misspoke. I meant 315 of searches, but certainly the Millett cases involve 513. That's a privilege, and it's an extremely strong privilege. I remember when it came out, there was talk about it might be an absolute privilege. And there's no issue of privilege here.
Correct.
The government also conceded that the Amazon records showed that it was untruthful at trial. And I would certainly agree, but that's not the whole story. Denied the Amazon records. She said a parent hacked her account or authorized her, accessed her account without authorization. And that was one of the specific things the defense requested. The government conceded at trial was relevant, but then was not available, allowing to deny it. Any questions?
Any questions?
I just have one, Chief Judge. Mr. Hockenberry, how do you respond to government counsel's statement that, hey, look, we gave you the Amazon records when the proper showing was made through a subpoena, and you didn't do that, not you, but the defense at trial didn't do that, and they could have with regard to this information at the time the military judge was considering or concluding his ruling on this legal theory that he came up with. How do you respond to that? I mean, one of the complaints is that, hey, look, you could have done something about this had the judge reconsider, but you didn't.
Your Honor, I think the defense, with remarkable foresight, forecast that in their motion. They say on JA at 484, one of the reasons we need this evidence is to show how the Amazon.com screenshot got on cell phone, because they knew there was going to be some controversy about this hacking allegation. The government says we concede that's relevant.
So that's the proper showing, in your view.
I think
the military judge should have considered and reconsidered and determined that, hey, look, I need to do a little more here.
Your Honor, I don't think it would take reconsideration, because that was raised in the original motion. When it got to trial and she kind of maintained her denial of these Amazon records, the discovery request is ongoing. The defense does not need to object again. They could have been revisited by the judge or the parties, but there was no need to. They had specifically raised that issue.
So in your view, he erred from the beginning when he made his ruling. He could have considered all of this. He was just wrong on his conclusion regarding the motion.
I do think that. I think it's ongoing.
703 motion.
Both, but I think it's ongoing and could have been reconsidered at trial, but I do think the error was, it's not that the error only ripened at trial. It was apparent at the time of the original ruling.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, Ms. Harkinberry, I'll give you an opportunity to briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government's position is contrary to the truth-finding function of the court-martial process, and on this record, the government has not proved harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. Court is adjourned until further order of the court.